From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, we remember comic playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. He died last Sunday. We'll listen back to our 1996 interview. His many hits include Barefoot in the Park, Brighton Beach Memoirs, and The Odd Couple. He said there were two sides of him that were at odds. One side was the writer.
The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Also, we'll hear from two Emmy nominees. John Oliver, whose satirical new show, Last Week Tonight, has 9 nominations. And Allison Janney, who's nominated for her performance in the sitcom Mom. And Kentucky Reviews, a new Roger Miller tribute album. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. On this holiday weekend, we're going into our archive to hear from two Emmy nominees. They'll find out if they're winners on Monday, September 17th. John Oliver's HBO satirical news show, Last Week Tonight, is nominated in 9 categories, including Outstanding Variety Talk Series, Outstanding Writing for a Variety Series, and Outstanding Interactive Program. Oliver moved to the U.S. from England in 2006. To become a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Oliver started his HBO show in 2014. He typically starts the show with a comic, trenchant review of the week's news, and then he takes a deep dive into one news story, a story that you may not have been following, a story you may not have thought was interesting, but through a combination of comedy and journalism, he makes it funny and really informative. Our interview was recorded last March. Here's a clip from the August 19th episode, in which the main story was about President Trump waging a trade war. Here's how Oliver started.
Trade is a subject on which our current president considers himself particularly expert.
Trade. That's what I'm going to do so good. I'll take those trade deals and make them so good. That's what I do. I love taking bad deals and making them good.
I love trade. You know, trade's always been my thing.
I could name 10 different forms of trade. I know every one of them. Hey, the Wharton School of Finance right here.
Yeah, I can name 10 forms of trade. There's a free trade, fair trade, rough trade, Trader Joe's, that's what, 8? Then there's human trafficking, that's like trading for people. We'll round it up and call it 10. Wharton School of Finance right here. Trump has talked a big game on trade for decades, and he spent...
John Oliver, welcome to Fresh Air, and glad your show is back on HBO.
Thank you.
So I always imagine your staff being a combination of journalists and comics, and the way it happens in my head...
Yeah.
Because I'm not there and I don't know anything about what's really going on. But the way it happens in my head is that you have a group of journalists who do this deep dive into a story, and then a group of comedy writers who turn that story into a comedic take, using all the investigative stuff that the journalists have come up with, that then the comics would transform that into a comic take on this really important story.
So yeah, that's a pretty good guess. That's a pretty good guess, Terry. You've just revealed our secret sauce live on air.
Tell me how it really works.
You've just Colonel Sanders'd our process. That's basically it. You know, we have researchers, we have footage producers, and they go away to look at a story and to check that it's been reported accurately or whether the story has shifted in any way, meaning that lots of the data that we'd be using would be out of date, and whether there is footage through which we can tell the story. Then once we feel like the basic foundations are solid, then we can kind of bring comedic writing to that process and work out how we'll tell the story, what elements of it we want to use, what kind of story arc we want to employ, and then we write jokes. So jokes come late.
One of the things you don't do is focus every show on President Trump. There's usually an opening in which you like review the events of the week, and of course...
Yes.
The president figures prominently in that, and there's no shortage of jokes in that opening segment about the president and Don Jr. and Jared and Ivanka. But the investigative part is usually not about the White House. How come? Stay away from that.
Yeah, I mean, we've done it a little bit, but yeah, the vast majority of our main stories are not about the day-to-day goings on in the White House. And even when we approach Trump in the main story, that what we'll try and do is find a framing device where, again, we can bring something slightly different to it, whether it's his relationship with the truth or whether it's the way that the world sees him and why that is a problem. But yeah, the majority of the time we try to get him out of the way as early as possible, if at all, and then move on to something that no one in their right mind wants to hear about. Often when we introduce that main story, there's quickly a sense of, and don't go, I promise, I give you my word, this is worth 22 minutes of your time, I promise.
Sometimes your segments, your long takeout segments, end with like a call to action. One of my favorites was about how easy it is to call yourself a church and get tax-exempt status.
Right.
And then with the tax-exempt status and various other loopholes, collect money from your followers, exploiting their problems and making promises you can't keep and then pocketing the money. So you became a mega reverend and started a church called Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption.
Exemption, that's yes. Correct. Praise be.
So with your wife, Wanda Jo Oliver, played by Rachel Dratch, you did a little TV show at the end of your segment on televangelists and did something on your church, Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption. And I want to play that clip.
Praise be to all of you watching us tonight or joining us online at www.ourladyofperpetualexemption.com.
But most of all, praise be to the IRS, most permissive of government agencies.
Wanda Joe, I have heard the word of prophecy.
Hallelujah! What did it say, Majah?
I'll tell you, Mawanda. It says the viewers at home must plant a seed.
A seed! An almighty seed!
Yes.
Preferably in the form of cash, although we do take checks.
It can be $5, it can be $10, it can be $77. We need you to sow your biggest seed.
That's money. Don't send us seed.
That's right, Wanda. Please do not send us actual seeds.
Because we ain't interested in your seed.
We ain't interested. Please send us your actual money to this address at the bottom of your screen. If you do this, and this is real, great things will happen to you, and that's apparently something I'm allowed to say.
Praise! Praise legal! Praise our tax attorney! Praise loopholes in all their blessed loopiness!
Let me talk to the brothers and sisters at home. Do you have debt?
Debt be gone!
Do you have lupus?
A demon plague!
Touch your hand to the screen right now, and we shall cure it. Touch your hand to the screen right now.
Curse you, demon lupus. Bedevil us no more.
Curse you, lupus. You probably didn't even know that you had lupus, but you did, but you don't anymore. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle tonight.
It's a miracle.
Miracle. Do not delay. Call this actual number right now, 1-800-THIS-IS-LEGAL. Because amazingly, all of this is all legal. Call this toll-free number and plant your seed.
That's really hilarious.
Rachel Dratch is so funny.
It's John Oliver and Rachel Dratch on an episode from Last Week Tonight on HBO. So, as you said, it's legal to say great things will come to you if you do this, if you pay the money and everything. So how did you find out what you could say?
I guess the fascinating thing for us there was to try and show, not just tell people that this was possible, because it feels, it's theoretically alarming to have someone say, and it's completely legal to do this. It's kind of viscerally affecting when you have someone say, give me your money, I will cure your lupus. Give me your money, if you do, you will get more money in return. Seriously, give me your money. And people sent it in. No tax obligations. It was kind of showing that you could hack into this system and everything was allowed. So, people sent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to us.
Why did they do that? Why did they? It's obviously, it's obviously a comedy sketch.
Because it's fun. Mm-hmm. Okay, we sent them back things. However, once they sent money, we sent them letters back, the kind of letters that we'd been receiving from the pastor that we'd been in contact with over the previous 6 months. He had, you know, an outline of his hand, and you could put your hand on his hand and pray with him that way. So we had an outline, I believe, of my rear end so that you could sit where I sat and we could pray together. So we kind of got into a correspondence with people. Then we eventually had to shut it down because it would have become our entire job. But the point of it was to show that the barrier of entry to this is too low. And when it's this low, you can have bad actors enter.
So what did you do with the money you collected?
We gave it to Doctors Without Borders.
So I want to give another example of you doing something related to the story that you're following, but doing it in the real world, not just in the confines of the studio. And this is really hilarious. I mean, you've been trying to slip information into Trump's mind, knowing that he watches Fox TV and that he often like tweets things that he's just heard on Fox.
Yeah,
so you actually bought ads on Fox TV, parroting an ad that often runs on Fox. And so to set this up, I just want to play the real Catheter Cowboy ad, or at least one of the real Catheter Cowboy ads that's run on Fox. And then we'll play the way that you parodied it, and then we'll talk about how you've done it. So here's a real ad that's run on Fox TV.
Attention, catheter patients on Medicare. I'm a professional cowboy, and I use catheters. Been cowboying for 25 years. I've broken 14 bones, had 2 concussions and a punctured lung. I know pain, and I don't want any more of it, especially when I cath.
Okay, so that's an excerpt of a real ad.
And real ad. Very real. Painfully, painfully real.
And here's the John Oliver Last Week Tonight ad, or at least one in a series of ads. And this one is about healthcare policy. And again, it's kind of geared to an audience of one. It's geared to President Trump to slip real information into his mind as he watches Fox News.
Attention, catheter patients.
Hi, me again. I'm a professional cowboy and I use catheters. Been cowboying for 25 years, and there's 2 things I know. I don't like pain when I cath, and healthcare is a complicated business. Everybody knows that. Literally, everybody. Also, if my premiums go up and subsidies go down, I'm going to wind up paying more. That's basic math there, fella. That's like replacing my catheter with a garden hose. I don't want that. I do not like pain when I cath. The point is, if that happens, millions of folks like me might get real angry, which is worth thinking about if you're the sort of person who really likes being popular. You get that, right? Right? You get that. Right?
Okay, so that's the parody ad from Last Week Tonight. So tell us the backstory to that.
Well, it was I think it was our first story of last season when we felt like we had to talk about Trump's relationship with the truth before we talked about anything else that year, because it felt like there'd been a seismic shift in the way that we were going to collectively live our lives in America. So yeah, the end of that was realizing that he was receiving a huge amount of information from early morning Fox News programming, which is not the kind of place you ideally want someone getting information that they will then act on. So this is a guy who has access to the best information available, and he's choosing to get it from these 3 circus clowns on a couch. So then we found a clip of him on Air Force One with the commercials from Fox News blaring loudly in the background. And we realized, oh, he watches the commercials too. So at that point, we felt this is the best way to try and get to him, is that you can become part of his morning briefing now. That's what's so egregious. Fox and Friends has always been a ludicrous program, but they have a huge responsibility now because they have the president's ear. So when they pass on misleading information or poorly framed data, it's going to have a real-world impact. So what we wanted to do was try and slip information into him when he's at his happiest and most relaxed, which is when he's zoning out to Fox and Friends.
Well, it's so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming back to our show.
Oh, you're welcome, Terry. It's always fun to talk to you.
John Oliver, recorded in March. His HBO series Last Week Tonight is nominated for 9 Emmys, including Outstanding Variety Talk Series, Outstanding Writing for a Variety Series, and Outstanding Interactive Program. After a break, we'll feature an interview with Allison Janney, who's nominated for her performance in the CBS sitcom Mom. And our rock critic Ken Tucker will review a new album featuring country music stars performing songs written by Roger Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next interview is with Allison Janney. She's nominated for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance on the CBS sitcom Mom. She's already won 2 Emmys for Mom. One was in 2014, the same year she won for her performance in Masters of Sex. She won 4 Emmys for her performance on The West Wing as White House Press Secretary C.J. Craig. This year, she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in I, Tonya. I spoke with her in 2014, and we started with a clip from the first season of Mom. Janney plays Bonnie. When the series begins, Bonnie is a single mother who's done a lot of drinking, partying, and sleeping around. But she'd recently gotten sober and was trying to improve her relationship with her adult daughter, who's had her own alcohol and drug problems. In this scene, Bonnie is calling her daughter in the middle of the night with some surprising news.
Hello?
Are you awake?
At 2:30 in the morning? You betcha.
I think I'm pregnant.
Oh, God, can I not be awake? How is that even possible?
What kind of question is that? I happen to be in the bloom of my life.
Half the men in Napa Valley have been in the bloom of your life.
What?
Nothing. Did you take a test?
I don't need to. I've got all the signs. I missed my period. I'm moody. My nipples are incredibly angry. Trust me, there's fruit in these loins.
So as we heard in that clip, there's a lot of laughter in the series. And in the scene that we heard, though, it's like, laughter after every single line.
I know.
Is that all laughter from the audience? Is there a laugh track too? Is the laughter sweetened?
Well, I know. Some people, it's amazing, but they're really, the live audience is there and they are laughing after every single line. And it's you have to hold. You have to, like you do on the stage in live theater, you have to hold for the laugh. And then when we don't get a laugh on a line, that
usually after the take, there'll be a big pause and the writers will be furiously thinking of new lines, and they come up with floor pitches is what they call them. And then they come in with notepads and tell us how to now say this time. And then they do the take again. And then if the audience laughs, we move on. If they don't, they keep writing. And it's kind of a crazy night, the tape night with the audience there. But those are all real laughs. And as to whether or not they use mix the laughs with other laughter, I don't really know. But I know that I'm there and I hear the audience laughing with us. So,
in the series, Mom, your character goes to 12-step meetings because she's a recovering alcoholic and mm-hmm. is only recently sober. I know that your younger brother committed suicide, and I believe he had been that he had had a drinking problem. And so I'm wondering what it's like for you to treat alcoholism in the kind of lighthearted way that the series does, after seeing, you know, how deadly it can actually be.
Yeah, it definitely was. The loss of my brother was a huge a moment, life changer for me, and I spent a long time trying to help him get sober. I sent him to countless rehabs. I tried to be there to help him. And when I lost him, I, you know, this show came, Mom came along 2 years after. And I thought, this is good. I feel like I am qualified to be in this world. I've gone to many Al-Anon meetings, many open AA meetings. I've been to rehab places with my brother. I just know that world. I had to go through it a lot, and I felt like I wanted to be a part. And I didn't feel that there was anyone was making fun of this process at all. I thought it was it was time to show a family struggling with this, because it just seems like these days everybody is struggling with being, you know, recovering from something. And I wanted to be part of that. I want to show what that's like.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Allison Janney. So I think a lot of people first got to know you as CJ, the press secretary on The West Wing. Let's hear a scene from that. And this is a scene, President Bartlett had MS, but he was not telling people about it. And in this scene, Oliver Platt, who plays the White House counsel, has learned that the president has MS and has been keeping it from the public. And he's trying to figure out who on the White House staff knew and has been helping in the cover-up and who didn't. So here he is questioning you about whether you participated in covering up that information.
Okay.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
When did he tell you?
I'm sorry?
When did the president tell you?
6 days ago.
And Josh?
2 days after that.
Toby?
2 days before he told me. CJ, have you ever lied about the president's health?
And Leo, he told more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this for 6 hours now, so maybe giving me some room wouldn't be totally out of line. You know what I'm saying, Oliver?
CJ, I'm going to have to ask you some questions. The less you can be pissed at the world for no particular reason, the better, I think.
I don't know you.
I'm sorry?
I was told to report to you. I don't know you. You've been here, what?
3 months.
3 months. So
yeah.
Why should I trust you?
Well, I don't care if you trust me or not.
Imagine my shock.
I got better things to do with my imagination.
I think this is going really well so far, Oliver. It's almost hard to believe that 4 different women have sued you for divorce.
Well, you can do that if you want, CJ. I've been through it a couple times with Josh and Toby, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer questions.
Either to you or
a grand jury.
Compelled by
a Justice Department subpoena.
Well, I have to tell you, it'll be the first time I've been asked out in quite a while, so
it's entirely possible that the president has committed multiple counts of a federal crime to which you were an accomplice.
That much has sunk in the last 6 hours.
Has it?
Yes.
So why don't you knock off the cutie pie crap and answer the damn question?
What was the question?
Have you ever lied about the president's health? What is your answer?
Many, many times.
Ooh, CJ's in trouble.
It's my guest, Allison Janney, with Oliver Platt in a scene from The West Wing. So I always wonder, when you do that kind of snappy retort type of Aaron Sorkin dialogue? Does it improve your ability to have witty retorts in real life and to have razor-sharp dialogue when you're speaking extemporaneously?
Oh, Terry, would that that were true. No. But no, I can't, I don't have that. I don't have that razor wit that CJ had. Politics scared the crap out of me because I did not grow up in a family where we talked about anything really but, you know, pass the peas and do this. I had no idea what I was talking about half the time, and I have to, you know, I'd study my lines and read and like, going, what the hell am I talking about? What? I learned a great deal doing that show and I loved it, but I felt just really fish out of water when we'd go to Washington and be, you know, go out to dinner. I'd meet the, you know, all the former press secretaries and you know, to be sitting around with Dee Dee Myers and Joe Lockhart and talking. I just would just get so nervous. I wouldn't know what to ask them. So I felt a real pretender to the throne.
Allison Janney, recorded in 2014, the year she won an Emmy for her performance in the CBS sitcom Mom. She's nominated again this year for her performance in Mom. There's a new Roger Miller tribute album featuring covers of the most famous songs he wrote and recorded, like King of the Road and the novelty songs Dang Me and You Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd. It also includes some great ballads that aren't nearly as well known. Before we hear Ken Tucker's review, here's how Miller sounded.
I've got half a mind to leave you, but only half the heart to go.
Roger Miller died in 1992 at the age of 56. The new album, King of the Road, a tribute to Roger Miller, features covers by some of country music's biggest stars, such as Dolly Parton, Casey Musgraves, Loretta Lynn, and Brad Paisley. Here's Ken's review.
Well, my name is Roger Miller, probably one of the greatest songwriters that ever lived, and I just want to... Let me humble up here for a second. Sam already kill me for that. I have written a few songs, probably 800 or 900 in my professional career, and I would like to do about 700 or 750 here tonight. Whatever we have time for.
That little 20-second audio clip leads off King of the Road, a tribute to Roger Miller, and it captures nicely the way Miller knew how good he was, even if his offhanded manner kept you from being aware of just how great he was. Miller started out a Nashville songwriter, and one of his early successes was The Last Word in Lonesome Is Me, a 1966 hit for Eddie Arnold. On this new tribute album, however, it gets a really wonderful new interpretation by Dolly Parton, who is joined by Alison Krauss.
The last word in lonesome is me. The last word is me. My heart is as lonely as a heart can be lonely. The last word in lonesome is me. Too bad.
Born in Fort Worth, Texas, Miller was one of the last country stars to come from the sort of poor rural background that the genre so frequently mythologizes. He picked cotton and was educated in a one-room schoolhouse. He didn't live in a house that had electricity until he was 15. He presented himself as a genial good old boy, but one possessed with a gift for verbal dexterity. There's a tightness to his rhyme schemes, a perpetual surprise to his word choices, an elasticity to the way he broke down the syllables of his punchlines in big hits like Chug-a-Lug, England Swings, and Dang Me. That last song gets a highly faithful rendition from Brad Paisley, who's basically doing a Roger Miller imitation, and a good one.
Well, here sit high, getting ideas. Ain't nothing but a fool would live like this. Out all night and running wild. Sitting home with a month-old child. Dang me, dang me. Oh, to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
Tribute albums are usually terrible things, alternately too slavish to the original material or sentimental distortions of the artist's original intentions. This one, featuring 36 tracks, contains just enough first-rate performances to make it worthwhile. The best example of an artist making a song her own is Kacey Musgraves' version of Kansas City Star. Miller wrote and recorded this song as a brisk, rollicking, humorous piece, a satire of showbiz fame. Musgraves takes the song and reshapes it as a loping piece of cowboy music.
Got a letter just this morning. It was postmarked Omaha. It was typed and neatly written, offering me this better job at higher wages, expenses paid, and a car. But I'm on TV here locally, and I can't quit. I'm a star. I come on the TV.
This collection features a very eclectic lineup that includes the actor John Goodman. He's here because he starred in the Broadway production of Miller's 1985 Tony Award-winning musical Big River. Ringo Starr also pops up, doing a forgettable version of a forgettable song called Hey, Would You Hold It Down? Much better is Rodney Crowell's achingly lovely rendition of a lesser-known Miller tune called World So Full of Love.
I know how it feels to be alive with no desire to live. I know how it feels to die inside and try hard to forgive. And my way of finding out was on the day you let me down. So full of love and not enough to go around. I was once so proud.
Even though he died of cancer when he was only 56, Miller's career spanned three decades. He's one of those songwriters who was so prolific and yet so good, there are many first-rate songs still waiting to be fully appreciated. And if you ever find a copy of his great but little-known 1970 album, A Trip in the Country, snap that sucker up. Miller is a guy who is perpetually worthy of rediscovery.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large at Yahoo TV. He reviewed King of the Road, a tribute to Roger Miller. Coming up, we'll listen back to an interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. He died last Sunday. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to listen back to an interview with comic playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. He died last Sunday at the age of 91. His New York Times obituary said his name was synonymous with Broadway comedy, and he helped redefine popular American humor with an emphasis on the frictions of urban living and the agonizing conflicts of family intimacy. Simon adapted several of his Broadway shows into films. His best-known titles include The Odd Couple, Barefoot in the Park, Come Blow Your Horn, Plaza Suite, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, Brighton Beach Memoirs, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He wrote the books for the musicals Sweet Charity and Promises, Promises. He started his career in the early days of TV, writing for Sid Caesar's Show and Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko. The TV series The Odd Couple was adapted from his hit play. He wrote the 1968 film adaptation. Let's start with a clip from the film. It starred Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon as two divorced men sharing an apartment, having the same kinds of problems with each other they used to have with their wives.
Oscar, what is it? Is it the cooking or the cleaning, the crying?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. The cooking, the cleaning, the crying. It's the talking in your sleep. It's those moose calls that open your ears at 2 o'clock in the morning. Can't take it anymore, Felix. I'm cracking up. Everything you do irritates me. And when you're not here, the things I know you're gonna do when you come in irritate me. You leave me little notes on my pillow. Told you 158 times I cannot stand little notes on my pillow. We are all out of cornflakes, F.U. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F.U. was Felix Unger.
I spoke with Neil Simon after the publication of his 1996 memoir, Rewrites. I asked how he developed his ear for dialogue.
I never thought about it much, but the only thing that came to me is that when I was a young boy, 5 and 6 and 7 years old, my parents would take me to visit their relatives, and for some reason, I think they thought that I was invisible because they never talked to me.
Right, or they talk about you even though you could hear?
I could hear, but they were talking family matters or gossip or whatever, and I just sat there, and once in a while they'd give me a cookie or something, and I just listened. It stuck in my head, and what I managed to learn was the way they talked, the choice of words they made, what it was that they were interested in. And years later, without knowing it, when I started to write about these people, I was able to draw on my own memory from what happened in those days.
Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, what, about 8 years older?
Eight and a half years older, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your mm-hmm. brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about 8 times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. My mother never knew when he was coming back, and the whole world lit up when he came back, because it meant not only did we not have to fear for the rent, because he didn't leave any money for us, we didn't have to worry about food, but I felt a solidity there with the family, and I felt happy for my mother. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship, and it makes me somewhat insecure at times. And it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money to take care of the family. And
yes, she was uneducated. Mm-hmm. She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was what she took in two men to live in our house, two boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom, and they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops. And it was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were foreign and spoke some English, but it was difficult, and it was not my father, and I felt I was living in not my house, but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
You write that your brother got you a whore shortly after your 21st birthday, and that was your sexual initiation.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, was that a good way to become initiated?
I don't know if it was a good way. It was the only way. I mean, if he left it to me, I'd be 54 before it happened. I'm sure glad it did happen. But it did change me. I mean, you have to get through that moment, because it was the most fearful moment of my life. And I don't know why it is, looking back. I mean, that you don't expect this woman to think that you should be expert at what you're doing, or that this is going to be a very personal affair and that we should like each other. It's really a cash and carry business, and you just do it. But I felt so much better having done it, and that I would never have to do it that way again, which I never did.
There's a similar but different scene in Biloxi Blues, where the character there also has his first experience with a prostitute, but that's on an army base, so it's...
Yeah, but the origin of that scene in that film was exactly what happened to me. I mean, it was with a prostitute.
Yeah.
It was his fellow friends bringing him there. There was a line in it that summed it up, because I felt the same way when it happened to me. He said, "I'm not expecting this to be a pleasurable experience. I just want to get through it."
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the odd couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, "Come out for dinner, come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready." Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, he cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And I watched this one night. I came up to Danny's apartment and Roy's apartment. I saw this taking place as they were getting prepared for this dinner. I was going to leave before the dinner happened. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, "Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it," because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages and finally called me and he said, "I can't do it." He says, "I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright." He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright, and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life, so I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because here was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, "This is the funniest play I've ever read." And I said, "You don't find it dark?" And he said, "No, not at all." So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
around?
Well,
I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And I also lost all of the stage rights of Barefoot in the Park. Never made a penny on that play from the day it opened.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cause to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things. And I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life. And I just went on to write other plays.
You write a little bit in your book about being in analysis. And you say that your first year of analysis was, in a sense, an attempt to introduce you to yourself, the two sides of you, one the writer and the other the person who doesn't write. Are these two sides of you at odds?
Well, they have been for years. They weren't always at odds. They were just different people. They were not the person that I was with my family, with my friends. The writer is a very solitary person who is, I guess in the worst sense, willing to pick the bones of somebody else's character and put it up there on the stage, even though I don't think I've ever hurt anybody by doing it because no one ever came up to me and said, how dare you put this up there on the stage. As a matter of fact, when I put my father up on the stage and Come Blow Your Horn, he came to see it, and I was very fearful of what he was going to say. And I said, what'd you think, Dad? And he says, oh, I know men just like that. He never saw himself in it at all, which is what most people do. Sometimes they people come up to me and they say, that was me you were writing about, wasn't it? And it wasn't at all anything that I was writing about. So about the two Neil Simons, yes. The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. But I find as time goes on, right about now, maybe as we're talking, that the two characters are becoming more wed to each other. I don't see the disparity in the two personalities anymore. It sounds like I'm a little psychotic, but I'm not, really.
Well, maybe that's because the two have lived together for so long, they've become more acclimated to each other.
I know. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Did analysis help?
Well, analysis, I think, helps in the long run. I never went for, like, long, long periods at a time. I would go from time to time when there was great trouble in my life, when my first wife died, when I had other personal problems. But after a while, I started to go because it was a way of learning about myself and about learning about other people, because the conversations were not only about this Neil Simon character. It was about how they are affected by other people in the world. And once you get into that subject, you start to talk about the other people in the world, and you realize that you do not live alone in this world. So it was very educational for me. I graduated, got a diploma. It was very nice.
I thought a kind of funny part of your book was, I guess it's the late 60s, early 70s, you were writing about the era of the so-called sexual revolution, and you were married, but you wanted in.
I wanted to be a part of this. Yeah, it wasn't the sexual revolution so much. I'd been married for 14 years, and I thought, I was looking at myself in a different way, and I said, you got married fairly young. I had very, very few experiences, except in the Grimm Hotel. And I was not looking, I didn't want to go out cheating on my wife. I didn't want to have a very negative kind of a life, but I felt I was so shallow in my experiences, so needy to know what the underbelly of life was like. And so it was more of a mind experience of wanting to know other things without having the danger of going through them. And so I did have a talk with my wife, almost asking to get out of the marriage for a while. And she took it so casually because she knew I wasn't going anyplace. She knew me better than I did. And I kept saying, well, I think I'm going to leave. And she said, oh, that's okay. When do you want to go? And I was shocked and amazed by her attitude. And I knew how much smarter she was than me and how much better she was than me. And when I reached the point when I felt that I already had my freedom because she had given it to me. And I said, never mind. And I never went anyplace.
You have a theory that you write about in the book, that your mind doesn't know when you're writing that it's only fiction. Your mind thinks you're actually living through whatever you're putting on paper.
Yes.
What has led you to this conclusion?
Because my body goes through the pain that I am going through in the writing. I feel the tenseness if I'm writing a scene between, let's say, a husband and wife who are having a fractious marriage. Things are going wrong. There's a big argument. There's a confrontation. I feel the intensity in my body, and I don't think I'm acting that out. I truly feel it. I'm exhausted when I go home. Whereas if I write something that's a funnier scene, a lighter scene, a more loving, romantic scene, I don't feel that same tension. I feel a lightness about me. So I don't think that the mind differentiates about what's going on in real life or what's going on in the fiction you're writing.
So fiction really does take its toll on you physically.
It does, but it's been very rewarding for me. I don't think I would like to have been anything else in life but a writer, but I also don't think I could have been anything else.
Did you ever try?
Well, no, I was too busy writing.
Right. Well, Neil Simon, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Neil Simon recorded in 1996. He died last Sunday at the age of 91. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.